All right, welcome everybody to this episode of Breaking Absolutes. This may be the most fun I've ever had on the show, or I'm ever going to have. I get to talk about a record that is continues to be and started my musical life, but so foundational, and not just for me, but for so many others. And I've got some fun things to talk about. With me, I've got John Petrucci from the band, who's been gracious enough to give me a little time to wax nostalgic, but then talk about how that really began a journey that brings them right up to some of, I think, the best music that they've ever made, with A View from the Top of the World. Let me just set up a little bit for folks who may know Dream Theater, but maybe remember them mostly for their early stuff, and kind of set up the conversation as I frame it with a band that's had a 30-plus year career, that's seen them bookended by charting on Billboard and then just recently winning a Grammy. This record, Images and Words, came out, 92, I think it was. John will keep me honest on it. But it hit like they had a pre-existing record, but there were some lineup changes and some maturity, I think, in the songwriting that we'll talk about, that resulted in a record that set an immensely high bar for progressive metal music, for themselves too, of course, and a bar that a lot of musicians, myself included, have forever tried to reach ourselves, which is good. I think that those standards like help us try and be our best selves. And so we use this music as a North Star to guide, you know, our own journeys. But the record, just a few bon mots on it. In 92, Billboard top Heat Seekers was hit number two. Greatest our German album charts, 94. It had three singles, Pull Me Under, still their best charting single at 10th, but Take the Time hit 29th, Another Day hit 22nd. They hit 61 on the Billboard 200, which is a pretty big deal. They are in the Italian charts, they hit 88, and Japanese charts, they hit. So even though they had a pre-existing record, interestingly, their sophomore record, which often you've heard the sophomore slump, was not that at all. In fact, quite the opposite, really sort of set them off. There are other chart positions, you know, and accolades. It was rated or certified gold in both Japan and the United States. And I think that those things are industry acknowledgments that are important, particularly back then. It's still true today, but they were in a time that was crowded with new music that was coming in and sort of shifting trends in music. So the fact that they established all of that without being a part of the trend, I think, is remarkable. So with that as my setup, let me bring John on. John, welcome.
Hey, what's going on, Peter?
Hey, man. First thing I have to say is thank you. You've been gracious with me in the past and again today. Give me a little time. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, both as a friend and as a musician. So first, thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate this. This is fun. I'm a big fan of yours. Obviously, you wrote the astonishing novel, and you're an awesome singer. And so this is my pleasure as well. And by the way, not a lot of people realize I actually live in the Images and Words room.
Yeah.
You are the
sleeper.
Yeah, I built my house. No. You know, the producer in me has to point something out. I don't know if you moved your mic before or something, and there's like a underlying weird hum every time you talk all of a sudden.
Oh, maybe I got a bad position.
I don't know what you did.
I don't know.
All right. Well,
you still hearing it?
I'm hearing it, but I don't want to hold it up.
It's not coming through on my end.
All right, cool. Maybe I'm just hearing it.
Well, so that'll be unfortunate for you, but the fans are not hearing it, and
perfect.
Post the video will be okay.
All right, perfect.
Okay, so I kind of want to dig in a little bit. I talked about the chart positions. It's really interesting to me, John, this journey that you've had, and we can't possibly cover it all, but I think the bookends make a nice way to frame the conversation, because while there was a first record, and I don't want to dismiss that, there was this sort of moment in time with Images and Words that set the band on a trajectory, with all the chart positions and industry acknowledgement. And then just recently, I think just in the past few days, I saw your Instagram pic holding the Grammy, right? And that is yet another like pinnacle of sort of industry acknowledgement. And I know it's not all about that, because if nothing, Dream Theater has been a fan-based band. I think I've told you before, I think once you guys win a fan, they're fans for life. They don't come in and out.
Right, right.
But what it suggests to me is, and I think all of the people that are Dream Theater fans would agree, is there's this consistency of striving for excellence. And I know that you and I both know that reactions to records are subjective, but over time, I think that this is a nod to the fact that the band, which is still a working writing band, is still firing on all its pistons. Do you have any reaction to that idea? I mean, is that part of how you feel about how you want to conduct your career?
Well, I do. That's a great way of putting it. You know, and this is something that's common with all the Dream Theater members. We still love doing what we do. You know, even though Images and Words came out July 7th, 92, so 30 years ago, you know, even though it's even longer than that since we've been a band, and there've been a couple of member changes, all of the members have this sort of attitude where we love doing what we do. We love being creative people. We still love practicing and playing our instruments. And when we get together to write, our headspace is always like, we just want to write the best thing we possibly can and never rest on our laurels or get lazy about it. Always go the extra mile. I know I feel that way as a producer. I'm always trying to figure out ways to make the band sound better and get the right people involved in the records. And so I think that's why we've had a consistent career. Somebody asked me the other day how we're able to sort of do that for a long period of time. And I think it's always, you know, raising the bar and trying to like keep the level as high as we can at all times. Yeah. Even as we present our live shows and the kind of touring we do, that's been a huge part of our career and a mainstay is our connection with our fans, as you mentioned, and the amount of touring all around the world that we do and that we've done for so many years now. So all those things, yeah. And you know, you mentioned it before, the Grammy thing, it's such a great nod because it's like, you don't see progressive bands or progressive metal bands win things like that. And so it kind of signifies part of the industry and community recognizing what we're doing in this type of music. And I think it's a great nod to like just Prague in general. So it's an honor to have had that. And these moments in our career, they are these milestone moments that you remember and you kind of think back on and how they help propel your career forward. But the idea of constantly striving to be your best and really truly enjoying what you do is at the bottom of it.
I think that comes through pretty clearly in music. Even though different records have a different personality, it's all ultimately Dream Theater. This is my little soapbox on fandom is, I think when you become enamored of a band, at least for me, you become really enamored of wanting to go on the journey with them. And that means the different type of records they want to write, the different headspace they're in when they're writing those records.
Yeah.
And you guys have always, whatever those existing conditions around you have been, the records have always just been sort of top drawer. And I think this is why you've garnered this fan base that persists over time. It's not for better or worse, you don't trend very often. You know, so you're not on TikTok trending. You know, I hate to say it, but a girl in her bathroom on her back singing some lip sync thing and it gets a gajillion views and then Warner signs them and they blow up. And then next week they don't have a career anymore. You guys are like musicians that care about the craft and over time have continued to put in that effort. And the fans know that. And the thing that's remarkable, John, is that this all arrived, even though the very first record I think is sometimes underrated and really good, but when you guys landed with this particular album, it was all there. I was re-listening to Images and Words, and then I was doing this thing where I was side by side listening to A View from the Top of the World. And while there's clearly differences and there's the band's grown and stuff, what's there's a presence in that very first record that continues. And I've got some comparisons I'll share in a minute, but it's remarkable to me that the maturity of songwriting and playing existed that far back. Is there like, how shall I account for that as a layman?
Right. Well, it's funny. I'm glad that you've noticed that and appreciate that. I think we sort of developed our sound, fortunately, pretty early on. And as much as the first record came out and really, you know, that was the first thing we ever did, people's introduction to the band. And you can hear on the first record what type of band we were. We were obviously, you know, a metal band that was playing progressive music, you know, with these long songs and different kind of arrangements and stuff like that. You know, the style of the band was definitely established, but Images established the sound.
Yeah.
Obviously it's when James came in, so it established the vocal aesthetic of the band.
Sure.
And it kind of just, for some reason, everything just came into focus on that record. I don't know if it was because we had done the first one, and then there was a whole period of time where we were auditioning singers and we didn't have a record label and we weren't sure what was going to happen. And we were working on this music. I don't know if it had to do with that or just the experience of the studio with David Prater and Derek Oliver having signed us, and that type of, you know, elation just to be back in that position where we can do this again. But everything sort of came together to where, as much as the first record was an introduction, Images was like, it established what we were going to be moving forward. And like you said, when you listen to A View, you can still hear that same kind of spirit and that, you know, that basic sound that we established then is still alive and well, you know.
Yeah.
Even though the band has evolved and changed and production techniques and things have changed, the identity of the band is very much cemented in Images and followed through on every record after that.
Yeah, it really has. And that I think that even includes the lyrical approaches. And I know that you guys have taken all kinds of themes and fictional narrative ideas over the years. But as I was looking at these two records, they both concern themselves in large part with the ideas of life and challenges of life, and ultimately the hope of reaching past those challenges to something. And those are not to be too high-minded about it, but those are really important things to write music about. And the band has, you know, it's not, I don't mean to suggest an over seriousness, because it's not that. It usually feels, just has this injection of hopefulness in the way that you represent these ideas. But the band's done that here and there all across the years. Do you think consciously about that, or is it an organic way that you approach when you write? Because I think I've told you this before, you know, all the lyrics are good, but you have a particularly incisive lyrical pen in my mind. I think it's, you do a wonderful job of expressing these ideas. And so I'm interested in whether it's something that's just really, really organic for you, or if you really think about it before you start getting the words down.
Right. Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I mean, part of it for me as a lyricist is I really focus in on, besides the meaning of whatever I'm writing on, the sounds of words and how they are conveyed by a singer. That's to me is just fascinating. And it's there's like a craft and an art to that, that when you get it right, it just like, it's so satisfying. So a lot of like the focus of my lyric writing has to do with crafting the words and sounds and rhymes and little clever things that goes into it as much as whatever the topic I'm writing about. Yeah. As far as it being organic, you know, I suppose it is. I think that, you know, for lyricists, a lot of your personality comes out. So the things that you're passionate about or into, or whatever happened to you in your life or whatever fictional story you're coming up with all has to do with your own experience. So in that sense, it is organic. But at the same time, there is a very conscious effort, at least on my part, to convey certain types of messages. Even if I write about something that's controversial, I try not to get too dark. I guess that's something that I do with my lyrics. I try to have a sense of hopefulness. You mentioned it before. Yeah. I like there, whether it's a fictional story or a real life story, I like there to be some sort of arc to the lyric in the song. And that's all conscious for sure. And that's all the craft. And I also try not to get too preachy. That's another thing. There's certain things that are turnoffs for me, like lyrics that are preachy or too self-important or political or things like that. You know, I kind of like to me, you know, music and art and movies and stuff like that, as much as it's their opportunities and their ways to make you feel things deeper, they're also escapes, you know? And exactly. So like, I like that kind of when going into a song and a lyric, even if it's a deeply personal topic, there's something about it. There needs to be some hope and some positivity. You know, for me at least, you know, I think that's important.
I think that's evident in the lyrics that you write. It's interesting knowing, the more I get to know about you, the more I feel like I see some subtext in some of the things that you write. Yeah. And I think that's a viable and interesting fan response is when, and I'm not the only one. And it's also what you said there is true, is your lyric writing usually turns hopeful. Even if there's areas where you're exploring the darkness, it's always with this idea of getting to some place that's hopeful.
There is. I mean, even with, you know, if you think about images, since we're talking about that, you know, for me, you have some two very different lyrical approaches, you know, one being Another Day, which was a very personal topic about the illness my father was going through. And even within that, I was trying to like have, you know, convey some hope, even though it was a very difficult time for me, for my dad, for my family. And then you have something like Metropolis, where it's totally fictional. And that's a whole different headspace where I'm just writing about something that didn't really happen. And you're just kind of using that creative part of your brain to tell a story. And that's a bit more detached emotionally. And it's, you know, it's just two different styles. And I tend to kind of go back and forth between those, even still to this day. But on images, you can hear the difference in the lyrical feel between those two songs. I think it's really, really evident.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to dig just a little deeper on a few of the songs, but before we get there, just a couple quick things about the record. Is it true? I think, and I saw this all over as I was kind of just preparing for our conversation. Originally Change of Seasons was going to be part of this record.
That is correct. Yeah. So that was a song that we had done and demoed and was supposed to be part of the record. In fact, we didn't learn that it was not going to be part of it until we were actually in the studio at Bear Tracks. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a phone call from Derek Oliver, and it's like, I don't want to put, you know, he was the A&R head of A&R who signed us.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't want to put that on the album. It's going to take it over an hour. He wanted to keep the record to an hour, and that, you know, would have to be a double CD, I guess, or whatever. Anyway, for whatever reasons, he wanted to leave that off and promised we'd do it as an EP later, which we did. I remember being really pissed and upset at the time. But retrospectively, it was definitely the right decision. And, you know, images and the track listing and the flow and the length is perfect. So he was right in thinking that.
Yeah. And the other, and I agree with that. But then I learned that Pull Me Under was like more of a last minute addition. Is that true?
It's a good question. It's hard. It's
hard to remember.
30 years ago, you know, I don't want to get this wrong. It could have been the last song we wrote. That is possible that it was the final song that we wrote. So it was later.
Well, what I read, and you can either correct the record or maybe, and it doesn't really matter, I guess. But said that Pull Me Under was a last minute addition replacing Don't Look Past Me.
That might be true.
Might be true. Well, we'll let the internet continue to believe that. We won't put a stamp of approval on it.
The funny thing is, like, some things I remember so vividly, and some things I'm like, wait, we did that? Really? You know, but I mean, something about that sounds pretty correct.
Well, the reason I thought it would be interesting if it were true is, right, I mean, that is the song that kind of blew up for you guys.
Sure, sure. And there was something really special about it. I remember, too, when the album was done and I had the mixes, whatever, and I, you know, would play that for friends or family. I was just so proud when the guitar came in. It's like, oh my God, you got to hear this, listen to this. And so it was such a great choice for an opener. And we had no idea, obviously, that it would end up being this rock radio hit. And, you know, we have a gold record and everything like that. We had no idea. Nobody thought that it was like an 8 minutes song, whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, thankfully that was on the record. But that's it. It definitely sounds familiar that it was like a later song, like maybe the last one we wrote. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I think you told me once I think the band was always going to have success, but though that early success of that single kind of catalyzed things, right? A rock radio hit does that for a lot of bands.
Yeah.
Because I remember it going from 0 to 60, at least from my perception. And that song was just so much active rotation on MTV.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and that's the way it works, because, you know, that song started to hit, and then, like you said, MTV and everything else, it's being played on the radio. People want to know about the band. I mean, I'm stating the obvious about promotion and music marketing, but then you get offered bigger gigs, and you're all of a sudden, everybody wants you to play. And that starts the band's career, basically. Next thing you know, we're booking shows in Japan and Europe and everywhere else.
Well, and then it's incumbent on the artist to, it's where we started, is staying consistent with writing and producing. And you've done that. One last thing, and then I want to dive in just to a couple of the tracks. I don't know if you knew this. Oh, you probably know some of this, but there are a legion of musicians, not just people who are still striving to gain some recognition, but those who have gained lots of recognition, who decided to do their thing because of images and words. And I learned one of these through this show. I was interviewing Tuomas Holopainen from Nightwish. And we were talking, and he said, I heard that record, and that's when I decided I wanted to have a band.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. I didn't know that. That's awesome to hear. That's really cool.
So in at least one small respect, Nightwish fans can thank you.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they could thank Rush if they want to go back. And
yeah, there you go. Keep going back.
Right.
So you mentioned that Another Day was written about your father's illness. We don't need to dig into that too much. Mm-hmm. And I know that later you wrote Take Away My Pain.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask you, though, if you can or you'll indulge me, is there's a section of the lyric that is extremely poetic.
Yeah.
And I can layer on sort of what I think they mean. I'm interested to know if they have particular meaning to you, other than just conveying emotion. And it's that section from They Took Pictures of Our Dreams Down.
I knew you would ask that.
You knew it. You knew it was coming. You've been asked this probably before. But it's this you're always poetic, but this particular these turns of phrase excite the mind towards some sort of nostalgia. They really do, John. And so I have to know if there's something about those you can tell me.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I haven't been asked about those, but sometimes I'm like nervous that people are going to ask about my more, you know, sort of esoteric lyrics, and I'm going to just try to remember what I was trying to say. You know, that song is very personal, and it did at the time. It was cathartic to sort of write about that subject. And basically that whole section, to me, it creates a lot of imagery. We're talking images and words. So
yeah.
I was trying to sort of describe this youthful feeling that, you know, when things were just more innocent before, you know, in our family, something turned, that happens to a lot of families. You know, if somebody gets an illness or if there's a tragedy in a family, whatever, sometimes there's comfort in, or it's cathartic to write about what it felt like to be in this sort of safe place, where that stuff wasn't happening. And that's basically what that section is trying to illustrate. It's, you know, it's definitely very abstract the way I wrote the words there. The way James sang it is brilliant. It's, you know, one of my favorite sections. A big influence of ours as well is Marillion, and that's a very Marillion section to me. Okay. And
I see that.
Yeah, and you know, I know this isn't a lyrical thing, but a lot of the sound of images from a guitar standpoint, there was this book, this chord book called Chord Chemistry. I've talked about it forever. Ted Green wrote it. And I was really studying this book, and a lot of these sort of chordal combinations and things that I learned, I injected into the images writing. And I remember stumbling upon that opening kind of part, the opening guitar motif, clean part, and just liking the sort of dissonance and the melancholy feeling it had, and that helped to decide what to write the song about lyrically. So it all ties in. But anyway, that book was a big influence. You hear a lot of these kind of cool chordal things going. But to get back to your question, that's the best way I could describe that sort of weird lyrical abstract thing, was my attempt to illustrate what it felt like to be, you know, in a safe place where maybe some of this other stuff wasn't actually happening, like almost like an altered timeline.
Yeah.
It
makes sense to me how you describe it, for sure.
Right. It's very childlike sort of section.
And there's the, what's great about it is it leaves just enough that the listener can place themselves in it with their own history, which is really, really cool. Yeah. There's this story about Take the Time, that had something to do with talking about the stuff the band had been through, and it was maybe the only song where you guys all divided up and wrote a part.
Right.
Do you remember the part you wrote?
Because
I think I, knowing your lyrics, I have a guess.
Yeah. So the second verse, I believe, is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Yeah, the second verse, which is the unbroken spirit.
I knew it.
Yeah. You know, just, my style.
I know your lyrical style. Yeah. I charted them all out, who I think are what, but, and if anybody wants to, I've got my notes that shows this is what I believe John wrote. This is a John turn of phrase. just a little bit of fun, but it's a great tune, of course. And I thought the idea of everybody helping express, you know, I guess this time of uncertainty and change, and was a cool idea to have you all collaborate in that way.
Well, it's interesting too, as I'm kind of going through the lyrics in my head, not that I'm not listening to what you're saying.
No, that's fine.
But you talked about the sort of like the hopeful nature of my lyrical style. And it's definitely very evident in that, especially the way it ends, about turning to hope, right? Right at the end, that literally uses the word.
It absolutely does.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Suppression that he feels must turn to hope. It's my favorite part of that particular song.
Yeah. So it's seeing the light out of the darkness. And, you know, I mean, I explore that topic a lot. Illumination theory is all about that.
Yeah, man.
You know, and even A View from the Top of the World in some ways is about that as well, about people pushing themselves to the brink of death, you know, because it makes them feel more alive. There's a lot of that theme going on.
Absolutely. I do have to ask a little bit about Metropolis. So I know that it's more abstract.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of internet theories about it being about Romulus and Remus building Rome. And whether that's true or not, it's a fun thing to think about. But I'm more interested in it feels like you've done some personification in this thing a little bit, or at least at the very least, there's this, these archetypes of death, deceit, and love being the dances, Where's I love the lyrical approach because I love the opportunity it provides me and all your other fans to kind of think about these things and look at them through the filter of our own experience. But I'm wondering, when you began this process, did you think like, were you in like a narrative mode? Did the music like suggest to you, I want to write a sort of an unspecific sort of narrative experience that works with archetypes? Or am I reading too much into it for you?
Well, you're reading into too much into it a little bit.
Okay.
You're not off base though. The music definitely dictated, I'm going to write something weird and epic. Yeah. So you're right on that. You know, honestly, I look for a lot of times, or some, I shouldn't say I look for, sometimes things hit me that I'm not looking for. It could be a story I read, something that happened, something that I heard that happened to somebody else, or a TV show, or like a news. In this case, it was a documentary, and it was something that I was watching, and it kind of impacted me. And it was all about the comparing these twins. I think the story was that they were separated, and one was received a lot of love and attention and close family, and the other one was totally neglected, and what ended up happening to the two.
Oh, wow. That's
basically what the story is about. Now, of course, I took a lot of creative license and just turned it into this whole, you know, epic adventure story with these dances and everything else. So it got a little bit weird and more fictional.
Yeah,
for sure. But that was the inspiration. That was the basic inspiration for that.
I don't think it's actually weird. Like I really like the use of the idea of these different, I guess, stages or experiences of life being seen as a dance.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. And the reason you have the miracle and the sleeper, it's basically, you know, that everybody is kind of like born with this untapped potential, and depending on your life path or how that's nurtured, you know, you could be a very happy and successful and prosperous person in all ways, or you could be downtrodden and, you know, never really see what the potential that you were born with. So I thought it was a really interesting topic. Again, a long time ago, you're talking 30 plus years ago. I remember watching something, and just that happens to me a lot. I'll watch something or read about something here, and I'll just like, I'll start thinking myself, like, that's such a weird thing. And then you start going off and having your own thoughts on it and wanting to explore that. And that's what I love about the kind of music that we write and play, is that it's the perfect backdrop to explore those things. You know, you don't have to fit some sort of topic in a 3-minute song. You could really go and explore it and get creative and have different sections and parts and characters and reoccurring themes and get all nerdy with it as much as you want. So I love that about, you know, prog music in general, that it allows us to have that opportunity as writers.
You've used that to good effect, certainly on this album, and I think as consistently across time.
Cool.
And not the least of which is with The Astonishing, where you did amazing narrative work.
Thank you.
The last one, and then I want to transition, and I want to pull this forward to today with the newest record.
Yeah. But
Under a Glass Moon is the other song that you treated lyrically on the album, which had, if I'm correct, the interesting prior title of The Battle of Jimmy Coco and Fish Face.
right. a lot of times we'll name songs based on what the riff sounds like somebody's trying to say. And I believe there was some riff in there that sounded like somebody saying that, and that was the title.
Well, as long as we're on that topic, it sounds like Metropolis was at one point crumbling Metropolis.
Right.
And the Pull Me Under was Oliver's Twist.
Oliver's Twist. You know, the interesting thing about that being Oliver's Twist, so Derek, it's obviously named after Derek Oliver, which would mean it probably was a later song, probably was the last song written. And the twist may have been that that song originally had the middle instrumental section of Erotomania in it. And maybe Derek was the one who suggested we take it out.
Oh, interesting.
And so it was an arrangement to it. So maybe the Oliver's Twist. You know who's really great at these questions is Portnoy. He has like elephant memory. He remembers every story thing. Yeah. But I think that might have been Oliver's twist was Derek Oliver's twist to take out the Erotomania section.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's really cool.
If it wasn't that, then the twist was that we weren't going to put on a Change of Seasons.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway,
yeah, I love the fun of the names. We used to do the same thing. The names were, we ended up keeping one. We had one called Basic Fish.
Nice.
We just left it.
As I love
we played
it.
Live Basic Fish. Okay. So if I want to do one summary thing. When I look across this record, not that this was your intent, but there definitely is a through line with Images and Words that has to do with life and death and the triumph of life and attaining dreams. Like it's present in almost every track. And it could be that I'm looking for it, but I can, you know, with it, I don't want to waste the time to do it, but there's not just musical movements that make you feel this way, but they've been expressed lyrically. And I think it's really cool that a record that was so successful did it without being so, you know, just inane. There's a lot of popular music is either overly narcissistic or I just find it's kind of inane lyrically. And I know, by the way, there's some people who really don't care about the lyrics at all, as long as the singer's on pitch. And that's valid. Everybody's music experience is valid, but I care about the lyrics.
Right.
And so when I look and I have this experience, I've listened to the album over the years, of course, but with the anniversary, and because this, did I ever tell you when I first heard this, I loved it and I hated it. I loved it because it's amazing. I hated it because as a fledgling vocalist, I was demoralized and thought I should just give up.
Oh no.
I was like, I can't make music like that. I better like go, you know, get a job.
Oh, that's really funny.
but of course I got over that very quickly. But then coming back to it and listening to it again, it's not dated. I mean, yes, people have debates, and I know Portnoy did himself about the snare drum trigger.
Sure.
But the music and the lyrics, all of that survives as well today as it did then. It's also still salient. Like because of the way you treated the themes, even if it was organic and not sort of fully mindful, is really salient. And so with that as a lens, I started listening to A View from the Top of the World. And as we won't go through that one as much detail because I know I want to be cognizant of your time.
Yeah.
And this is about Images and Words, but I can kind of summarize that one, that there's this notion inside it that there's a theme around life and the time we have, finding a way to survive, to live fully, overcome challenges, get the best out of ourselves. And these things are 100% consonant with some of the lyrical work in Images and Words. And then I started thinking after listening to A View from the Top of the World a couple of times the past few days, I realized like, the through line is not just the thematics. I care about that stuff because I write books, but it's the consistency in the play. Like you guys are known for that. You're all really stunningly good players, but the songwriting has remained a constant. We talked about it at the beginning, like you guys care about that. So there was a maturity even back then. You've continued to build on that. It seems like you are willing or you naturally treat this music with lyrical ideas that just have this like added resonance. They're usually not puff pieces.
Yeah.
So my takeaway from this, John, was that for fans that heard Pull Me Under 30 years ago, and by the way, I heard it just the other day on Sirius Radio.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was on Hair Nation of all places.
Oh, that's great. Awesome.
I thought, you know, there's people who are big fans in that time.
Sure.
Anybody who maybe hasn't stayed current with the band, this is my encouragement to them, is that you guys are making music as good, if not better, than you were 30 years ago. I don't want to throw shade at Images. Images,
sure,
foundational record. But it's not like you guys are still, I keep saying firing on all pistons. Like all of the musicianship is still at this level. There's still the hunger to write the best thing you can write.
Right.
Anyway, I think it's a remarkable thing to be able to say that after, especially at the altitude of with which you guys are making music, because you're known as that kind of band. And I wonder, like, does it feel that way to you? Or is this just sort of a fan lens I'm looking through?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. I mean it, Peter. I really appreciate you saying something that powerful, because, you know, isn't that the best thing that any musician or creative person can hear, that what they're doing currently is resonating just as much or more as something they did 30 years ago with yeah. somebody. So I really appreciate that. That makes me feel very happy. You're also very perceptive as a great lyricist and novelist writer, and you pick up on things very precisely, as you did with the Images and Words thread, whether we meant it or not. And that continuing along in A View from the Top of the World with people's experiences, overcoming adversity, you know, having a positive outlook, and how we deal with those things and treat those situations, and overcome those situations. You're right. That's you're totally, totally on the money with all that. And again, you know, we like I said in the beginning, we love doing what we do. You know, we're very thankful that we're able to have a career in music and get to play our instruments and, you know, be in a studio or on stage and having people appreciate what we do and sharing that with people. We never take that for granted. And so the combination of loving what you do and, you know, having the opportunity to do it over and over again is also so exciting, because every time you go in to do another record, it's like you roll up your sleeves. All right, what are we going to do now? You know, this is so yeah. much fun. And until that fun stops, you know, we're going to approach it every session, every show with that same kind of spirit of enthusiasm and wonder. Makes it, you know, I mean, music is such a special thing in all of our lives. So,
well, because you guys were willing to sort of follow your hearts in terms of the kind yeah. of music you wanted to make,
yeah.
you carved your own niche.
Right.
So you've been sort of impervious to a lot of the trends. And yeah. because you've stayed committed, as you've just described, you've kept those fans and you've earned new fans. I encourage everybody to like, for me, I know I go back when I do these sorts of things or out of nostalgia when there's an anniversary.
Right.
But honestly, when you guys put out a new record, it goes in my CD, because I still buy CDs.
Yeah.
Goes in my CD player, and it stays in my CD player probably till the next Dream Theater record comes out.
Nice. Nice.
And so I'll go back, but I listen to the current stuff. And as I've just done that again with this sort of book, these bookends, it was remarkable to me to sort of be able to see the quality of play and composition. The fact that you won, you know, industry acknowledgments, then you're winning them now.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. It's just this beautiful legacy that you've created for yourself. And I wanted to, I know you've done some other conversations probably around the anniversary, but what was important to me is try and really say it in a way that it's not, hey, they used to be great.
Right. Right. Well, no, I appreciate that. I love your take on it and your whole perspective today. And, you know, we're very, very fortunate. And one of the things I love about the people that listen to our music and fans of our music is that they anticipate the new music that we come out with yeah. and look forward to that just as much as they're nostalgic about the old music. And, you know, as a fan of any band, you might have a certain song or record that you prefer more, sure. or you love this, or you like this certain period. But man, when we go and we play live and we're playing everything from a brand new song back to back with one of the first things we ever wrote, and we get the same kind of reaction, that says so much, you know, that we love that. It's not like people are sitting there bored, we're playing a new song and then cheering when we're playing an old. It's like the same amount of enthusiasm and love from the audience comes back to us, whether we're playing The Count of Tuscany or A View from the Top of the World or Pull Me Under. So yeah. I love that. I really love that. I think it's rare, for bands to have that, that have had a long career. And so again, we value that so much. So
yeah, it was exactly the experience I had when you guys were in Seattle on tour.
Nice. Awesome, so, man.
Well, are you, before I let you go, are you doing anything interesting around the anniversary with the guys, or will it just be like a group text and say, we're still here?
Yeah. Yeah. Probably just a group text. We're all in different places right now. So no plans of getting together, but yeah, we'll probably have a toast when we are back together. Our next show is actually in Indonesia in August. Yeah. So that'll be the next time we're all together. So, but yeah, probably just group text. Hey,
well, my friend, it was a life-changing record for me. Put me on a musical path, and I've been a fan
nice.
Since. And the new stuff is every bit as good. Every bit as good. That's not me just throwing a bon mot your way. I love the new stuff as much.
Thank you.
So, folks who see this, you're probably Dream Theater fans, but if you haven't stayed current with these guys, check out their current records. I have every confidence you're going to love them. And John, awesome. I hope you have I have one more question. It was just 4th of July. Did you grill?
I didn't grill. No, I did not grill. We were in the city and we enjoyed the fireworks in Manhattan, and I thought about you
because you told me you got yes. the big grill. I thought that guy's man. Cooking up some meat today.
You know what? I sorry to disappoint you, but I promise I'll grill tomorrow.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, right, hey, cool. Thanks so much for the time. Congratulations on the Grammy, but on a career that was well begun and still going strong.
Thanks, buddy. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take good care.
All right. Talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye. To this episode of Breaking Absolutes. This may be the most fun I've ever had on the show or I'm ever going to have. I get to talk about a record that is continues to be and started my musical life, but so foundational, not just for me, but for so many others. And I've got some fun things to talk about. With me, I've got John Petrucci from the band, who's been gracious enough to give me a little time to wax nostalgic, but then talk about how that really began a journey that brings them right up to some of, I think, the best music that they've ever made with A View from the Top of the World. Let me just set up a little bit for folks who may know Dream Theater, but maybe remember them mostly for their early stuff, just kind of set up the conversation as I frame it with a band that's had a 30-plus year career, that's seen them bookended by charting on Billboard and then just recently winning a Grammy. This record, Images and Words, came out 92, I think it was. John will keep me honest on it. But it hit like they had a pre-existing record, but there were some lineup changes and some maturity, I think, in the songwriting that we'll talk about, that resulted in a record that set an immensely high bar for progressive metal music, for themselves too, of course, and a bar that a lot of musicians, myself included, have forever tried to reach ourselves, which is good. I think that those standards like help us try and be our best selves. And so we use this music as a North Star to guide, you know, our own journeys. But the record, just a few bon mots on it. In 92, Billboard Top Heat Seekers was hit number 2. Greatest our German album charts, 94. It had 3 singles. Pull Me Under, still their best charting single at 10th. But Take the Time hit 29th. Another Day hit 22nd. They hit 61 on the Billboard 200, which is pretty big deal. They are in the Italian charts, they hit 88. In Japanese charts, they hit. So even though they had a pre-existing record, interestingly, their sophomore record, which often you've heard the sophomore slump, was not that at all. In fact, quite the opposite, really sort of set them off. There are other chart positions, and accolades. It was rated or certified gold in both Japan and the United States. And I think that those things are industry acknowledgments that are important, particularly back then. It's still true today, but they were in a time that was crowded with new music that was coming in and sort of shifting trends in music. So the fact that they established all of that without being a part of the trend, I think, is remarkable. So with that as my setup, let me bring John on. John, welcome.
Hey, what's going on, Peter?
Hey, man. First thing I have to say is thank you. You've been gracious with me in the past and again today. Give me a little time. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, both as a friend and as a musician. So first, thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate this. This is fun. I'm a big fan of yours. Obviously, you wrote the astonishing novel, and you're an awesome singer. And so this is my pleasure as well. And by the way, not a lot of people realize I actually live in the Images and Words room.
Yeah.
You are the
sleeper.
Yeah, right? I built my house. No. You know, the producer in me has to point something out. I don't know if you moved your mic before or something, and there's like a underlying weird hum every time you talk all of a sudden.
Oh, maybe I got a bad position.
I don't know what you did.
I don't know.
All right. Well,
you still hearing it?
I'm hearing it, but I don't want to hold it up.
It's not coming through on my end.
All right, cool. Maybe I'm just hearing it.
Well, so that'll be unfortunate for you, but the fans are not hearing it, and
perfect.
Post the video will be okay.
All right, perfect.
Okay, so I kind of want to dig in a little bit. I talked about the chart positions. It's really interesting to me, John, this journey that you've had, and we can't possibly cover it all, but I think the bookends make a nice way to frame the conversation, because while there was a first record, and I don't want to dismiss that, there was this sort of moment in time with Images and Words that set the band on a trajectory, with all the chart positions and industry acknowledgement. And then just recently, I think just in the past few days, I saw your Instagram pic holding the Grammy, right? And that is yet another like pinnacle of sort of industry acknowledgement. And I know it's not all about that, because if nothing, Dream Theater has been a fan-based band. I think I've told you before, I think once you guys win a fan, they're fans for life. They don't come in and out.
Right, right.
But what it suggests to me is, and I think all of the people that are Dream Theater fans would agree, is there's this consistency of striving for excellence. And I know that you and I both know that reactions to records are subjective, but over time, I think that this is a nod to the fact that the band, which is still a working writing band, is still firing on all its pistons. Do you have any reaction to that idea? I mean, is that part of how you feel about how you want to conduct your career?
Well, I do. That's a great way of putting it. You know, and this is something that's common with all the Dream Theater members. We still love doing what we do. You know, even though Images and Words came out July 7th, 92, so 30 years ago. Yeah. You know, even though it's even longer than that since we've been a band, and there've been a couple of member changes, all of the members have this sort of attitude where we love doing what we do. We love being creative people. We still love practicing and playing our instruments. And when we get together to write, our headspace is always like, we just want to write the best thing we possibly can and never rest on our laurels or get lazy about it. Always go the extra mile. I know I feel that way as a producer. I'm always trying to figure out ways to make the band sound better and get the right people involved in the records. And so I think that's why we've had a consistent career. Somebody asked me the other day, how we're able to sort of do that for a long period of time. And I think it's always, you know, raising the bar and trying to like keep the level as high as we can at all times, even as we present our live shows and the kind of touring we do, that's been a huge part of our career and a mainstay is our connection with our fans, as you mentioned. And the amount of touring all around the world that we do and that we've done for so many years now. So all those things. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned it before, the Grammy thing. It's such a great nod, because it's like, you don't see progressive bands or progressive metal bands win things like that. And so it kind of signifies that part of the industry and community recognizing what we're doing and this type of music. And I think it's a great nod to like just Prague in general. So it's an honor to have had that. And these moments in our career, they are these milestone moments that you remember and you kind of think back on, and how they help propel your career forward. But the idea of constantly striving to be your best and really truly enjoying what you do is at the bottom of it.
I think that that comes through pretty clearly in music. Even though different records have a different personality, it's all ultimately Dream Theater. This is my little soapbox on fandom is, I think when you become enamored of a band, at least for me, you become really enamored of wanting to go on the journey with them. And that means the different type of records they want to write, the different headspace they're in when they're writing those records. And you guys have always, whatever those existing conditions around you have been, the records have always just been sort of top drawer. And I think this is why you've garnered this fan base that persists over time. It's not a, you're not, you know, for better or worse, you don't trend very often, you know, so you're not on TikTok trending, you know, I hate to say it, but a girl in her bathroom on her back singing some lip sync thing and it gets a gajillion views and then Warner signs them and they blow up. And then next week they don't have a career anymore. You guys are like musicians that care about the craft and over time have continued to put in that effort. And like, fans know that. And the thing that's remarkable, John, is that this all arrived, even though the very first record I think is sometimes underrated and really good, but when you guys landed with this particular album, it was all there. I was re-listening to Images and Words, and then I was doing this thing where I was side by side listening to A View from the Top of the World. And while there's clearly differences and there's the band's grown and stuff, there's a presence in that very first record that continues. And I've got some comparisons I'll share in a minute, but it's remarkable to me that the maturity of songwriting and playing existed that far back. Is there like, how shall I account for that as a layman?
Right. Well, it's funny. I'm glad that you've noticed that and appreciate that. I think we sort of developed our sound, fortunately, pretty early on. And as much as the first record came out and really, you know, that was the first thing we ever did, people's introduction to the band. And you can hear on the first record what type of band we were. We were obviously, you know, a metal band that was playing progressive music, you know, with these long songs and different kind of arrangements and stuff like that. You know, the style of the band was definitely established, but Images established the sound.
Yeah.
Obviously it's when James came in, so it established the vocal aesthetic of the band.
Sure.
And it kind of just, for some reason, everything just came into focus on that record. I don't know if it was because we had done the first one and then there was a whole period of time where we were auditioning singers and we didn't have a record label and we weren't sure what was going to happen and we were working on this music. I don't know if it had to do with that or just the experience of the studio with David Prater and Derek Oliver having signed us and that type of, you know, elation just to be back in that position where we can do this again. But everything sort of came together to where, as much as the first record was an introduction, Images was like, it established what we were going to be moving forward. And like you said, when you listen to A View, you can still hear that same kind of spirit and that, you know, that basic sound that we established then is still alive and well, you know.
Yeah.
Even though the band has evolved and changed and production techniques and things have changed, the identity of the band is very much cemented in Images and followed through on every record after that.
Yeah, it really has. And that I think that even includes the lyrical approaches. And I know that you guys have taken all kinds of themes and fictional narrative ideas over the years. But I like, as I was looking at these two records, they both concerned themselves in large part with the ideas of life and challenges of life, and ultimately the hope of reaching past those challenges to something. And those are not to be too high-minded about it, but those are really important things to write music about. And the band has, you know, it's not, I don't mean to suggest an over seriousness, because it's not that. It usually feels, just has this injection of hopefulness in the way that you represent these ideas. But the band's done that here and there all across the years. Is, do you think consciously about that, or is it, you think it's just a way you, is it an organic way that you approach when you write? Because I think I've told you this before, you know, all the lyrics are good, but you have a particularly incisive lyrical pen in my mind. I think it's, you do a wonderful job of expressing these ideas. And so I'm interested in whether it's something that's just really, really organic for you, or if you really think about it before you start getting the words down.
Right. Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I mean, part of it for me as a lyricist is I really focus in on, besides the meaning of whatever I'm writing on, the sounds of words and how they are conveyed by a singer. That to me is just fascinating. And it's there's like a craft and an art to that, that when you get it right, it just, like, it's so satisfying. So a lot of like the focus of my lyric writing has to do with crafting the words and sounds and rhymes and little clever things that goes into it as much as whatever the topic I'm writing about. Yeah. As far as it being organic, you know, I suppose it is. I think that, you know, for lyricists, a lot of your personality comes out. So the things that you're passionate about or into, or whatever happened to you in your life, or whatever fictional story you're coming up with, all has to do with your own experience. So in that sense, it is organic. But at the same time, there is a very conscious effort, at least on my part, to convey certain types of messages. Even if I write about something that's controversial, I try not to get too dark. I guess that's something that I do with my lyrics. I try to have a sense of hopefulness. You mentioned it before. Yeah. I like there, whether it's a fictional story or a real life story, I like there to be some sort of arc to the lyric in the song. And that's all conscious for sure. And that's all the craft. And I also try not to get too preachy. That's another thing. There's certain things that are turnoffs for me, like lyrics that are preachy or too self-important or political or things like that. You know, I kind of like to me, you know, music and art and movies and stuff like that, as much as it's their opportunities and their ways to make you feel things deeper, they're also escapes, you know? And exactly. So like, I like that kind of when going into a song and a lyric, even if it's a deeply personal topic, there's something about it. There needs to be some hope and some positivity. Yeah. You know, for me at least, you know, I think that's important.
I think that's evident in the lyrics that you write. No, it's interesting knowing, the more I get to know about you, the more I feel like I see some subtext in some of the things that you write. Yeah. And I think that's a viable and interesting fan response, is when, and I'm not the only one. And it's also what you said there is true, is your lyric writing usually turns hopeful. Even if there's areas where you're exploring the darkness, it's always with this idea of getting to some place that's hopeful.
There is. I mean, even with, you know, if you think about images, since we're talking about that, you know, for me, you have some two very different lyrical approaches, you know, one being Another Day, which was a very personal topic about the illness my father was going through. And even within that, I was trying to like have, you know, convey some hope, even though it was a very difficult time for me, for my dad, for my family. And then you have something like Metropolis, where it's totally fictional. Yeah. And that's a whole different headspace, where I'm just writing about something that didn't really happen. And you're just kind of using that creative part of your brain to tell a story. And that's a, a bit more detached emotionally. And it's, you know, it's just two different styles. And I tend to kind of go back and forth between those, even still to this day. And, but on Images, you can hear the difference in the lyrical feel between those two songs. I think it's really, really evident.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I want to dig just a little deeper on a few of the songs, but before we get there, just a couple quick things about, the record. Is it true? I think, and I saw this all over as I was kind of just preparing for our conversation. Originally, Change of Seasons was going to be part of this record.
That is correct. Yeah. So that was a song that we had done and demoed and was supposed to be part of the record. In fact, we didn't learn that it was not going to be part of it until we were actually in the studio at Bear Tracks. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a phone call from Derek Oliver, and it's like, yeah, I don't want to put, you know, he was the A&R head of A&R who signed us.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't want to put that on the album. It's going to take it over an hour. He wanted to keep the record to an hour, and that, you know, it would have to be a double CD, I guess, or whatever. Anyway, for whatever reasons, he wanted to leave that off and promised we'd do it as an EP later, which we did. I remember being really pissed and upset at the time. But retrospectively, it was definitely the right decision. And, you know, Images and the track listing and the flow and the length is perfect. So yeah, that he was right in thinking that.
Yeah. And the other, and I agree with that. But then I learned that Pull Me Under was like more of a last minute addition. Is that true?
It's a good question. It's hard. It's
hard to remember.
30 years ago, you know, I don't want to get this, the
get it wrong.
This wrong. It could have been the last song we wrote. That is possible that it was the final song that we wrote. So it was later.
Well, what I read, and you can either correct the record or maybe, and it doesn't really matter, I guess, but said that Pull Me Under was a last minute addition replacing Don't Look Past Me.
That might be true.
Might be true. Well, we'll let the internet continue to believe that. We won't put a stamp of approval on it.
The funny thing is, like, some things I remember so vividly, and some things I'm like, wait, we did that? Really? You know, but I mean, something about that sounds pretty correct.
Well, the reason I thought it would be interesting if it were true is that is the song that kind of blew up for you guys.
Sure, sure. And there was something really special about it. I remember, too, when the album was done and I had the mixes, whatever, and I would play that for friends or family. I was just so proud when the guitar came in. It's like, oh my God, you got to hear this, listen to this. And so it was such a great choice for an opener. And we had no idea, obviously, that it would end up being this rock radio hit. And, you know, we have a gold record and everything like that. We had no idea. Nobody thought that it was like an 8 minutes song, whatever.
Thankfully
that was on the record. But that's it. Definitely sounds familiar that it was like a later song, like maybe the last one we wrote.
It was I think you told me once that I think the band was always going to have success, but though that early success of that single kind of catalyzed things, right? A rock radio hit does that for a lot of bands. Because I remember it going from 0 to 60, at least from my perception. And that song was just so much active rotation on MTV.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the way it works, because, you know, that song started to hit, and then, like you said, MTV and everything else, it's being played on the radio. People want to know about the band. I mean, I'm stating the obvious about promotion and music marketing, but then you get offered bigger gigs and you're all of a sudden, everybody wants you to play. And that starts the band's career, basically. Next thing you know, we're booking shows in Japan and Europe and everywhere else.
Well, and then it's incumbent on the artist to, it's where we started, is staying consistent with writing and producing. And you've done that. One last thing, and then I want to dive in just to a couple of the tracks. I don't know if you knew this. Oh, you probably know some of this, but there are a legion of musicians, not just people who are still striving to gain some recognition, but those who have gained lots of recognition, who decided to do their thing because of Images and Words. And I learned one of these through this show. I was interviewing Tuomas Holopainen from Nightwish. And we were talking, and he said, I heard that record, and that's when I decided I wanted to have a band.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. I didn't know that. That's awesome to hear. That's really cool.
So in at least one small respect, we Nightwish fans can thank you.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they could thank Rush if they want to go back and
yeah, there you go. Keep going back.
Right.
So you mentioned that Another Day was written about your father's illness. We don't need to dig into that too much. Mm-hmm. And I know that later you wrote Take Away My Pain.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask you, though, if you can or you'll indulge me, is there's a section of the lyric that is extremely poetic.
Yeah.
I can layer on sort of what I think they mean. I'm interested to know if they have particular meaning to you, other than just conveying emotion. And it's that section from They Took Pictures of Our Dreams Down.
I knew you would ask that.
You knew it was coming. You've been asked this probably before, but it's this, you're always poetic, but this particular, these turns of phrase excite the mind towards some sort of nostalgia. They really do, John. And so I have to know if there's something about those you can tell me.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I haven't been asked about those, but sometimes I'm like nervous that people are going to ask about my more, you know, sort of esoteric lyrics, and I'm going to try to remember what I was trying to say. You know, that song is very personal, and it did at the time, it was cathartic to sort of write about that subject. And basically that whole section, to me, it creates a lot of imagery. We're talking images and words. So
yeah.
I was trying to sort of describe this youthful feeling that, you know, when things were just more innocent before, you know, in our family, something turned, that happens to a lot of families, you know, if somebody gets an illness or if there's a tragedy in a family, whatever, sometimes there's comfort in, or it's cathartic to write about what it felt like to be in this sort of safe place, where that stuff wasn't happening. And that's basically what that section is trying to illustrate. It's, you know, it's definitely very abstract the way I wrote the words there. The way James sang it is brilliant. It's, you know, one of my favorite sections. A big influence of ours as well is Marillion, and that's a very Marillion section to me. Okay. And
I see that.
Yeah, and you know, I know this isn't a lyrical thing, but a lot of the sound of images from a guitar standpoint, there was this book, this chord book called Chord Chemistry. I've talked about it forever. Ted Green wrote it, and I was really studying this book, and a lot of these sort of chordal combinations and things that I learned, I injected into the images writing. And wow. I remember stumbling upon that opening kind of part, the opening guitar motif, clean part, and just liking the sort of dissonance and the melancholy feeling it had. And that helped to decide what to write the song about lyrically. So it all ties in. But anyway, that book was a big influence. You hear a lot of these kind of cool chordal things going. But to get back to your question, that's the best way I could describe that sort of weird lyrical abstract thing was my attempt to illustrate what it felt like to be, you know, in a safe place where maybe some of this other stuff wasn't actually happening, like almost like an altered timeline.
Yeah.
It
makes sense to me how you describe it, for sure.
Right. It's very childlike sort of section.
And there's what's great about it is it leaves just enough that the listener can place themselves in it with their own history, which is really, really cool. Yeah. There's this story about Take the Time that had something to do with talking about the stuff the band had been through, and it was maybe the only song where you guys all divided up and wrote a part.
Right.
Do you remember the part you wrote?
Because
I think I knowing your lyrics, I have a guess.
Yeah. So the second verse, I believe, is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Yeah. The second verse, which is The Unbroken Spirit.
I knew it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just, my style.
I know your lyrical style. Yeah. I charted them all out, who I think wrote what, but, and if anybody wants to, I've got my notes that shows, this is what I believe John wrote. This is a John Turner phrase. Just a little bit of fun, but it's a great tune, of course. And I thought the idea of everybody helping express, you know, I guess this time of uncertainty and change, and was a cool idea to have you all collaborate in that way.
Well, it's interesting too, as I'm kind of going through the lyrics in my head, not that I'm not listening to what you're saying.
No, that's fine.
But you talked about the sort of like the hopeful nature of my lyrical style. And it's definitely very evident in that, especially the way it ends about turning to hope, right? Right at the end, that literally uses the word.
It absolutely does.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Suppression that he feels must turn to hope. It's my favorite part of that particular song.
Yeah. So it's seeing the light out of the darkness. And, you know, I mean, I explore that topic a lot. Illumination theory is all about that.
Yeah, man.
You know, and even A View from the Top of the World in some ways is about that as well, about people pushing themselves to the brink of death, you know, because it makes them feel more alive. There's a lot of that theme going on.
Absolutely. I do have to ask a little bit about Metropolis. So I know that it's more abstract.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of internet theories about it being about Romulus and Remus building Rome. Mm. And whether that's true or not, it's a fun thing to think about. But I'm more interested in it feels like you've done some personification in this thing a little bit, or at least at the very least, there's these archetypes of death, deceit, and love being the dances. I love the lyrical approach, because I love the opportunity it provides me and all your other fans to kind of think about these things and look at them through the filter of our own experience. But I'm wondering, when you began this process, did you think were you in like a narrative mode? Did the music like suggest to you, I want to write a sort of an unspecific sort of narrative experience that works with archetypes? Or am I reading too much into it for you?
Well, you're reading into too much into it a little bit.
Okay.
You're not off base, though. The music definitely dictated, I'm going to write something weird and epic. Yeah. So you're right on that. You know, honestly, I look for a lot of times, sometimes things hit me that I'm not looking for. It could be a story I read, something that happened, something that I heard that happened to somebody else, or a TV show, or like a news. In this case, it was a documentary, and it was something that I was watching, and it kind of impacted me. And it was all about the comparing these twins. I think the story was that they were separated, and one was received a lot of love and attention and close family, and the other one was totally neglected, and what ended up happening to the two.
Oh, wow. That's
basically what the story is about. Now, of course, I took a lot of creative license and just turned it into this whole, you know, epic adventure story with these dances and everything else. So I got, you know, it got a little bit weird and more fictional.
Yeah,
for sure. But that was the inspiration. That was the basic inspiration for that.
I don't think it's actually weird. Like I really like the use of the idea of these different, I guess, stages or experiences of life being seen as a dance.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. And the reason you have the miracle and the sleeper, it's basically, you know, that everybody is kind of like born with this untapped potential, and depending on your life path or how that's nurtured, you know, you could be a very happy and successful and prosperous person in all ways, or you could be downtrodden and, you know, never really see what the potential that you were born with. So I thought it was a really interesting topic. Again, a long time ago, you're talking 30 plus years ago. I remember watching something, and just that happens to me a lot. I'll watch something or read about something here, and it'll just like, I'll start thinking myself, like, that's such a weird thing. And then you start going off and having your own thoughts on it and wanting to explore that. And that's what I love about the kind of music that we write and play, is that it's the perfect backdrop to explore those things. You know, you don't have to fit some sort of topic in a 3-minute song. You could really go and explore it and get creative and have different sections and parts and characters and reoccurring themes and get all nerdy with it as much as you want. So I love that about, you know, prog music in general, that it allows us to have that opportunity as writers.
You've used that to good effect, certainly on this album, and I think as consistently across time.
Cool.
And not the least of which is with The Astonishing, where you
have
amazing narrative work.
Thank you.
The last one, and then I want to transition, and I want to pull this forward to today with the newest record.
Yeah.
Under a Glass Moon is the other song that you treated lyrically on the album, which had, if I'm correct, the interesting prior title of The Battle of Jimmy Coco and Fish Face.
Right, right. A lot of times we'll name songs based on what the riff sounds like somebody's trying to say. And I believe there was some riff in there that sounded like somebody saying that, and that was the title.
Well, as long as we're on that topic, it sounds like Metropolis was at one point crumbling Metropolis.
Right.
And the Pull Me Under was Oliver's Twist.
Oliver's Twist. You know, the interesting thing about that being Oliver's Twist, so Derek, it's obviously named after Derek Oliver, which would mean it probably was a later song, probably was the last song written. And the twist may have been that song originally had the middle instrumental section of Erotomania in it. And maybe Derek was the one who suggested we take it out.
Oh, interesting.
And so it was an arrangement to it. So maybe the Oliver's Twist. You know who's really great at these questions is Portnoy. He has like elephant memory. He remembers every story thing. Yeah. But I think that might have been Oliver's twist was Derek Oliver's twist to take out the Erotomania section.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's really cool.
If it wasn't that, then the twist was that we weren't going to put on A Change of Seasons.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah, I love the fun of the names. We used to do the same thing. The names were, we ended up keeping one. We had one called Basic Fish.
Nice.
We just left it.
I love it.
Live Basic Fish. Okay. So I want to do one summary thing. When I look across this record, not that this was your intent, but there definitely is a through line with Images and Words that has to do with life and death, and the triumph of life, and attaining dreams. Like, it's present in almost every track. And it could be that I'm looking for it, but I can, you know, I don't want to waste the time to do it, but there's not just musical movements that make you feel this way, but they've been expressed lyrically. And I think it's really cool that a record that was so successful did it without being so, you know, just inane. There's a lot of popular music is either overly narcissistic, or I just find it's kind of inane lyrically. And I know, by the way, there's some people who really don't care about the lyrics at all, as long as the singer's on pitch, and that's valid. Everybody's music experience is valid, but I care about the lyrics.
Right.
And so when I look and I have this experience, I've listened to the album over the years, of course, but with the anniversary, and because this, did I ever tell you when I first heard this, I loved it and I hated it. I loved it because it's amazing. I hated it because as a fledgling vocalist, I was demoralized and thought I should just give up.
Oh, like, no.
I was like, I can't make music like that. I better go, you know, get a job.
Oh, that's really funny.
but of course I got over that very quickly. But then coming back to it and listening to it again, it's not dated. I mean, yes, people have debates, and I know Portnoy did himself about the snare drum trigger.
Sure.
But the music and the lyrics, all of that survives as well today as it did then. It's also still salient, like because of the way you treated the themes, even if it was organic and not sort of fully mindful is really salient. And so with that as a lens, I started listening to A View from the Top of the World. And as I, we won't go through that one as much detail because I know I want to be cognizant of your time.
Yeah.
And this is about images and words, but I can kind of summarize that one, that there's this notion inside it that there's a theme around life and the time we have, finding a way to survive, to live fully, overcome challenges, get the best out of ourselves. And these things are 100% consonant with some of the lyrical work in Images and Words. And then I started thinking after listening to A View from the Top of the World a couple of times the past few days, I realized like the through line is not just the thematics. I care about that stuff because I write books, but it's the consistency in the play. Like you guys are known for that. You're all really stunningly good players, but the songwriting has remained a constant. We talked about it at the beginning, like you guys care about that. So there was a maturity even back then. You've continued to build on that. And you seem like you are willing, or you naturally treat this music with lyrical ideas that just have this like added resonance. They're usually not puff pieces.
Yeah.
So my takeaway from this, John, was that for fans that heard Pull Me Under 30 years ago, and I heard it just the other day on Sirius Radio.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was on Hair Nation of all places.
Oh, that's great. Awesome.
I thought, you know, there's people who are big fans in that time.
Sure.
Anybody who maybe hasn't stayed current with the band, this is my encouragement to them, is that you guys are making music as good, if not better, than you were 30 years ago. I don't want to throw shade at Images. Images,
sure,
foundational record. But it's not like you guys are still, I keep saying, firing on all pistons. Like all of the musicianship is still at this level. There's still the hunger to write the best thing you can write.
Right.
Anyway, I think it's a remarkable thing to be able to say that after, especially at the altitude of with which you guys are making music, because you're known as that kind of band. And I wonder, does it feel that way to you? Or is this just sort of a fan lens I'm looking through?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. I mean it, Peter. I really appreciate you saying something that powerful, because, you know, isn't that the best thing that any musician or creative person can hear, that what they're doing currently is resonating just as much or more as something they did 30 years ago with somebody. So I really appreciate that. That makes me feel very happy. You're also very perceptive as a great lyricist and novelist writer, and you pick up on things very precisely, as you did with the Images and Words thread, whether we meant it or not. And that continuing along in A View from the Top of the World with people's experiences, overcoming adversity, you know, having a positive outlook, and how we deal with those things and treat those situations and overcome those situations. You're right. That's you're totally on the money with all that. And again, you know, we like I said in the beginning, we love doing what we do. You know, we're very thankful that we're able to have a career in music and get to play our instruments and, you know, be in a studio or on stage and having people appreciate what we do and sharing that with people. We never take that for granted. And so the combination of loving what you do and, you know, having the opportunity to do it over and over again is also so exciting, because every time you go in to do another record, it's like you roll up your sleeves. All right, what are we going to do now? You know, this is so much fun. And until that fun stops, you know, we're going to approach it every session, every show, with that same kind of spirit of enthusiasm and wonder. Makes it, you know, music is such a special thing in all of our lives. So,
well, because you guys were willing to sort of follow your hearts in terms of the kind of music you wanted to make, you carved your own niche.
Right.
So you've been sort of impervious to a lot of the trends. And because you've stayed committed, as you've just described, you've kept those fans and you've earned new fans. I encourage everybody to like, for me, I know I go back when I do these sorts of things or out of nostalgia when there's an anniversary.
Right.
But honestly, when you guys put out a new record, it goes in my CD, because I still buy CDs.
Yeah.
Goes in my CD player, and it stays in my CD player probably till the next Dream Theater record comes out.
Nice. Nice.
And so I'll go back, but I listen to the current stuff. And as I've just done that again with this sort of book, these bookends, it was remarkable to me to sort of be able to see the quality of play and composition. The fact that you won, you know, industry acknowledgements, then you're winning them now.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. It's just this beautiful legacy that you've created for yourself. And I wanted to, I know you've done some other conversations probably around the anniversary, but what was important to me is try and really say it in a way that it's not, hey, they used to be great.
Right. Right. Well, no, I appreciate that. I love your take on it and your whole perspective today. And, you know, we're very, very fortunate. And one of the things I love about the people that listen to our music and fans of our music is that they anticipate the new music that we come out with. Yeah. And look forward to that just as much as they're nostalgic about the old music. And, you know, as a fan of any band, you might have a certain song or record that you prefer more, sure, or you love this, or you like this certain period. But man, when we go and we play live and we're playing everything from a brand new song back to back with one of the first things we ever wrote, and we get the same kind of reaction, that says so much, you know, that we love that. It's not like people are sitting there bored, we're playing a new song and then cheering, we're playing an old. It's like the same amount of enthusiasm and love from the audience comes back to us, whether we're playing The Count of Tuscany or A View from the Top of the World or Pull Me Under. So yeah. I love that. I really love that. I think it's rare for bands to have that have had a long career. And so again, we value that so much. So.
Yeah, it was exactly the experience I had when you guys were in Seattle on tour.
Nice. Awesome, man.
Well, are you, before I let you go, are you doing anything interesting around the anniversary with the guys, or will it just be like a group text and say, we're still here?
Yeah. Probably just a group text. We're all in different places right now. So no plans of getting together, but yeah, we'll probably have a toast when we are back together. Our next show is actually in Indonesia. In August. Yeah. So that'll be the next time we're all together. So, but yeah, probably just group text. Hey.
Well, my friend, it was a life-changing record for me. Put me on a musical path, and I've been a fan since. And the new stuff is every bit as good. Every bit as good. That's not me just throwing a bon mot your way. I love the new stuff as much.
Thank you.
So folks who see this, you're probably Dream Theater fans, but if you haven't stayed current with these guys, check out their current records. I have every confidence you're going to love them. And John, awesome. I hope you have I have one more question. It was just 4th of July. Did you grill?
I didn't grill. No, I did not grill. We were in the city and we enjoyed the fireworks in Manhattan, and I thought about you
because you told me you got the big grill. I thought that guy's cooking up some meat today.
You know what? I sorry to disappoint you, but I promise I'll grill tomorrow.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, right, hey, cool. Thanks so much for the time. Congratulations on the Grammy, but on a career that was well begun and still going strong.
Thanks, buddy. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take good care.
All right. Talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.